You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, if you have trouble falling asleep, a bedtime story might do the trick. We'll talk with an author whose goal is to help you doze off before you reach the end of the story.
First, 2018 saw some big news in climate change. The United Nations issued a landmark report saying if global emissions aren't reduced, things like food shortages and natural disasters could be coming just two decades from now.
And last month, 13 federal agencies in the U.S. released a report saying the American economy could shrink by as much as 10% by the end of the century if major efforts aren't made.
But while the Trump administration has deprioritized climate change, our next guest says renewable energy advocates in Wisconsin have reason to cheer about some major efforts around the state.
Tyler Huebner is the executive director of Renew Wisconsin, a group that advocates for more renewable energy in the state. Tyler, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with a look back at 2018. What kind of trends did you see here in Wisconsin when it came to renewable energy?
Well, nationally, there's been some tremendous trends over the past decade. The cost to install large-scale solar power is down 88%, and the cost to install wind power is down 69%, both since 2009, and that is really driving substantial changes among our power companies across the country, and now we're starting to see that in Wisconsin with really major commitments to renewable energy as we look forward.
Yeah, going back to even the 1970s, the beef against solar and wind energy was that per unit of electricity produced, it wasn't economically viable. It just cost too much to build and maintain. Are we seeing now electricity prices from renewables competitive with the coal, the natural gas, the oil?
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's completely flipped. And now a lot of our utilities in the state are seeing that it's going to be less expensive to build solar and wind going forward than it has been to even operate their existing coal power plants. And so we're starting to see this shift right here in Wisconsin away from coal and towards solar and wind power.
Right. A lot of the story seems like it's been over the years about, you know, a house here, a house there, a business there. You are starting to see this happening on a utility-wide scale. Can you talk about some of the projects we've seen in Wisconsin or that are in the works?
Yeah, absolutely. And make no mistake, the economics for a homeowner, a business, a nonprofit to put solar on their roof are also fantastic. They've gotten a lot better. And so as a cost-saving measure, that is a great opportunity right now. But because the costs have come down so much, solar is starting to really scale. And now in Wisconsin, we're seeing for the first time truly what we would call utility-scale solar farms being proposed that would really replace or displace coal power plants, natural gas plants that utilities typically operate. So that's an exciting new evolution in solar in Wisconsin.
Talk about long-term goals that you're hearing from utilities when it comes to how much carbon they're going to emit over the next 40, 50 years.
Yeah, Xcel Energy, which has service in 12 states, including much of western Wisconsin, has committed to 100% carbon-free by 2050. And that really was a nation-leading commitment that they just made about a month ago. To do that. Again, the costs have come down. They're doing extensive modeling. They know kind of what it's going to take to get there. And they also said, hey, some technologies are going to have to evolve and advance for us to make this happen, but we think that that will happen over the next 30 years. In addition, our other major power companies, We Energies, Wisconsin Public Service, Madison Gas and Electric, and Alliant Energy, have also committed 80% carbon reductions by 2050. So all of our major power companies that are investor-owned, it's called, they serve about 80% of the state. They now all have targets at least in line with or surpassing the Paris Climate Agreement that was referenced earlier in the opening.
Tyler Huebner is with us, Executive Director of Renew Wisconsin, talking about the year in renewable energy and looking ahead to the future. Tyler, how much are solar and wind power reliant on subsidies, especially from the federal government at this point?
Well, there still are tax credits available, but those are phasing out. And I think that's one thing that the industries are really excited about, is that we've gotten a long-term commitment back in 2016 from the federal government to continue those tax credits but start to phase them down. And the wind power tax credits will be phasing away entirely, and the solar will be phasing down to 10%. And so, you know, as that kind of works itself out, there's going to be a lot of wind and solar built, And both of those industries think they're going to be able to compete then dollar for dollar, even with drastically reduced or no federal subsidies at all. So we are looking forward to this long-run trajectory where solar and wind just compete on cost with everything else and win. So we're excited for that future.
Is there a ceiling, though, for solar and wind in Wisconsin? People point out that, you know, the sun is not always shining, especially this time of year. The wind is not always blowing. Aren't we going to still need a baseline of fossil fuels to meet all of our electricity needs?
Well, it's really evolving. The conversation around sort of base load energy has been what we've traditionally called it. And now the future is looking much more about flexible. So how do we have resources that are flexible? And there's a lot of excitement around energy storage technologies, really pioneered in our computers and our laptops and our phones. And that technology is going to cars now, like Tesla, and a lot of manufacturers are making electric cars. And so the costs are coming down dramatically for that. And now we think we're going to be able to use that for the power grid to balance out the sunny days, the windy days, with days that aren't as sunny or windy. So it's going to be a transition, there's no question, between where we are today and where that ultimate future lies. But we're very excited about the cost reductions and the technological evolutions that have enabled this pathway to a dramatically increased amount of renewable energy for Wisconsin.
One story you might be watching, we get a lot, as I understand it, of our solar power technology, especially from China. There are these concerns about a tariff war with China. Mm-hmm. Is that something you see as a roadblock ahead?
Well, it certainly is a drag. I don't know that it's a roadblock in the sense that we aren't getting around it, but what we've seen nationally is those tariffs on not only the solar panels, but also on steel and other commodities are, you know, slightly raising the price of projects, and so therefore they are slowing down the advancement nationally of solar. So it's a much bigger thing, though, those tariffs and our interactions. We are seeing some of those solar manufacturers and new ones spring up in the United States to really beef up our domestic capability to make solar panels. So it's really a global industry, and there's a lot of evolutions going in a lot of different ways.
Now, you are on an advisory committee, as I understand it, for incoming Governor Tony Evers on general energy issues. What kind of things are you hoping to see in Wisconsin state government when it comes to renewable energy?
Yeah, well, clearly we're going to have split government. And so, you know, we do think renewable energy, there's a lot of public support for solar and wind and energy conservation and energy efficiency. So we think there's opportunity for bipartisan and pragmatic solutions to keep these industries growing and to keep these opportunities coming for Wisconsin. And in addition, through executive orders or through the state of Wisconsin's own buildings and our university campuses, you know, the state has a lot of buildings. That's an opportunity for the state to be a leader. And we've done that in the past. And now that the costs have come down so much for solar and wind, we're hoping the state can really be a leader and take advantage of solar and wind and working with our power companies on partnerships and contracts to expand the amount of renewable energy that's being produced and used by our state buildings and campuses.
We'll leave it there for now. Tyler, thanks for joining us today.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
That was Tyler Huebner with Renew Wisconsin with us for a look at the future of renewable energy here in Wisconsin. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a dream about hibernation.
Some animals hibernate to survive the winter. Humans aren't included in that group, but that hasn't stopped writer Krista Eastman from imagining her perfect winter abode.
Before natural historians understood that some birds fly thousands of miles south each winter, they looked for other ways to explain their disappearance. Birds were like snakes, they suggested, burrowing for themselves a hibernaculum, an earthy pocket in which to pass the winter. Under the ground, the robin slumbered, her heart beating once in a while, her open throat not tweeting at all, her feathers caked in grit. This was another way to survive the winter, digging in, admitting no one, waiting for this too to pass. Deep into the winter blues, I awake to early morning darkness and wonder, is there really no other place for people and animals to live? Is there no other way? Some people are practical in coping with the season. Swift in booking cheap flights to Florida, they do not hesitate, they do not dally, they just depart. I am a member of that other tribe, those who dig in, those who let their thoughts grow warped on the grayest light of winter. At some point, usually around January 14th, I surrender to the season. My most insignificant problems begin to appear to me as uncontainable irritations, crosswords I'm much too grumpy to solve. It's hard, then, not to fantasize about my own hibernaculum, how I'd stock mine with a 5-month supply of coffee, chocolate, cheese, and wine to be consumed in that order every day, all winter long. Add to that a pile of books and a landline that only dials out for delivery. This would be the season of slow and silent contemplation, moderate melancholy, little to no exercise. A wise friend of mine claims this is what winter is for, a natural slowing down, a time to reflect, a not so unhealthy space for feeling a little bit sad. If it were possible, I think I'd also loft my hibernaculum in a tree and make of it a warm and protected nest. And then I'd also probably appoint someone responsible for yanking open the nest trap door once spring had truly come. I'd fall to the ground in an unwashed heap, stand up, blink my eyes. I imagined then that my pitying neighbors would gather round to watch as I stood for the first time in months, stretching muscles, cracking joints. "She smells even worse than last year," one of them might mutter, as I crab walk off to the lake for a bracing spring rinse. But I won't do any of that, of course, not really. I will climb out of bed when my son wakes each morning. I will be on time for work. I will remember to bring home that carton of eggs. But someday I will also emerge vainglorious from winter's pocket. It will be suddenly warm, and I will be suddenly awake, and soon, my naked ankles frisky from sun, I'll wonder, what could be better than here? What way is there but this?
Krista Eastman's essays have appeared in the Georgia Review, the Kenyon Review, and other journals. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit our website at wisconsinlife.org and find us on Facebook and on Twitter. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And coming up, we'll stay on the sleep theme with an author who writes stories that help grown-ups fall asleep. That's coming up next on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest says a lot of people are graduating high school without a lot of basic life skills. It's time to bring back home economics classes.
But first, reading kids a bedtime story to help them fall asleep has been in the parental playbook for pretty much forever. That trick apparently works on adults as well.
The founders of Calm, which is a meditation and relaxation app, were captivated by the descriptive writings of British author Phoebe Smith. She also happens to be a sleep expert, so they asked her if she'd be interested in contributing to their Sleep Stories series. She said yes, and now uses her nature-inspired travel experiences to write tales that send listeners to dreamland.
Here's a clip of her most popular story called Blue Gold, as narrated by British actor Stephen Fry.
You'll smell it before you even see it. That unmistakable aroma that fills your nose and seeps into your senses, instantly mellowing into a smooth and soothing scent. You breathe deeply, inhaling and exhaling this floral cloud, and as you do, something unexplained washes over you. Slowly at first, you feel your body begin to release its pent-up tension. Your breath becomes deeper, deliberate, calm.
Phoebe Smith is an adventurer, travel writer, broadcaster, and presenter in the UK. She's also the editor at large of Wanderlust Travel Magazine and the sleep storyteller in residence at Calm.com. Phoebe, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. Good to speak to you.
Thank you so much. First of all, normally, you know, putting your audience to sleep is what you don't want to do. So how did you feel when you were first approached about this idea?
I have to admit, I wasn't sure whether I should be wildly offended or flattered because, you know, someone says, oh, I read one of your stories and I think it would be great as a bedtime story to send grown-ups to sleep. And you sort of think, was it that boring? But but then I got my head around it and thought, when you think about the stories that you're read to as a child, it's not that they're boring. You actually ask to listen to them because you want to hear them. So they're interesting, but they kind of toe that line between getting you interested enough to want to hear it, but relaxed enough and so focused on it enough that you kind of can just drift off to sleep. So that was the challenge.
Now, you personally, you have battled insomnia for years. Can you talk about that? And was that the inspiration, or at least part of it, behind this idea?
Yeah. So as an adventurer, I actually put myself in very strange situations to spend the night. So I camp in very extreme places. So dangling off cliffs, inside glaciers, you know, the more extreme, the better. And I noticed that when I was doing those things, I was so focused on that particular thing I was doing that I slept really well. So the more crazy places I went to, that's when I could get a good night's sleep. But when I was back in my bed, sort of surrounded by all my things, my computer to one side, my phone, you know, suddenly all the noise is there and it's very difficult to fall asleep. So it definitely gave me inspiration to think, well, what would it take to kind of, what is it about these things that distracts me enough that I'm not thinking about everything else? And it is that focus on one thing. And so these stories work by doing that. They kind of get people interested and focused on one thing that they're very interested in. But then it's the way it's written, the way it's narrated, the way it's produced that gets people to kind of fall asleep.
So you're talking about the way it's written and the way it's produced. Is there anything else that leads to the goal of putting people to sleep?
Yeah, the words are so important and the structure of the story. So unlike traditional travel writing, which I, you know, still do for newspapers, magazines and radio, with those, you're trying to grab the reader's attention and kind of build tension as it goes. And, you know, pull them with you all the way to the end. So with this, it flips that completely on its head. So anything even remotely exciting or dramatic has to happen right at the start of the story. And then from that point on, it's all about using a lot of descriptive language, imagery, alliteration. So, you know, you heard Stephen Fry saying about, you know, soothing senses. And it's getting those words that make you feel relaxed just by hearing them. So I'm very careful when I'm writing it to make sure nothing jars the reader. So nothing like a crack or, a break or a word that would make them kind of sit up and listen like that. It's all about choosing the words. And when I write them, I speak it aloud as I go to make sure that just because it reads nicely in my head, once it's narrated, it doesn't kind of jar a listener so that they would wake up again.
Phoebe Smith is an adventurer, travel writer, broadcaster, and presenter in the UK. She's also a sleep expert, and we're talking about sleep stories, how to put adults to sleep by listening to bedtime stories right here on Central Time. Now, you were talking about Stephen Fry, and I'll get to him in just a second, but I wanted to go back. Your stories, they have plots and characters, or are they just mostly like first person, you're walking into a field type stuff?
it's a mix. So most of mine are nonfiction. So they're still travel stories. Some of them are written describing you going through a place so that the listener can feel like they're there. Others are just very descriptive of the journey itself without sort of saying you, using the pronoun. So it's all based on places I've traveled to for work and experienced on various projects and adventures. And so I think that's really important because if you have been to that place or you know it very well and something's said that's not quite right, it doesn't ring true, that would also wake you up. So it's kind of using the experiences that I've had and being able to kind of tell a really interesting kind of journey, almost, I'd say. So for instance, one of them I did that was based in the US, sort of in your region, was following the Mississippi from the sea right up to the source in Itasca, and obviously traveling through Wisconsin as part of that. So it's a meandering journey describing how that river changes from its kind of widest point, where it kind of empties into the Gulf, to going right up into kind of the big lakes and countryside and forest that you have up there in the north.
Now, we played that snippet from Blue Gold with Stephen Fry, and I admit, when I listened to it, I almost fell asleep myself.
Perfect.
Just his voice. His voice was great. Now, according to the article in The Guardian, it's your most popular. Why do you suppose people like this one so much?
I think yes, Stephen Fry definitely helps. He's got such a beautiful voice. But also, I think, you know, the Lavender Fields of Provence is kind of an iconic destination. It's one of those places people kind of want to go to. And the idea of lavender for centuries, you know, from Roman times, the word lavender comes from, you know, to wash, to clean. It's always kind of been linked with people to sort of de-stressing, to winding down, to relaxing. So I think you've got a combination of a beautiful place, lavender, which already kind of gives you that sense of calm. And then you've got a beautiful voice that's talking to you and sending you off to sleep.
And finally, Phoebe, with about a minute left, what kind of sleep story are you working on now?
My most recent one is meandering through the canals and waterways of the UK, funnily enough. So I've come right back close to home here for a different waterway. And they always, I have a narrowboat myself. And when I first got in the waterway, someone told me it was the fastest way of slowing down. And so I hope to translate that into my story.
Phoebe, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you spending the time. Phoebe Smith is an adventurer, travel writer, broadcaster, and presenter in the UK. We talked with her about her role as sleep storyteller in residence at Calm.com and her stories designed to help adults fall asleep.
Coming up, being out in the so-called real world also requires real-life skills, and our next guest says our young people might not be learning enough of them. We'll hear the case for bringing back home economics class. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Conner. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, if you could ban one word or phrase from the English language, what would it be? The creators of the annual Banished Words list join the show with the latest nominees. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network.
First, some questions for you. Do you have the skills to mend a pair of pants in need of repair? Do you have a rotation of basic meals to cook for yourself? Do you understand the concept of property taxes? That might be more than some young people can say, and our next guest says bringing back home economics class could help fill in some of those gaps.
While home economics was once a standard class, it's often been abbreviated or kicked to the curb with budget cuts and changing curriculum. We heard from some of you on Facebook when we asked how your own home economics experiences affected you.
Dee tells us, I had to take 2 years of Latin and skip another year of foreign language in order to have the time to take home ec, but it was worth it. I use the information I learned in that class every day. Ryan said, I did take it in 6th and 7th grade. I still use the sewing skills and even made my son's Halloween costume this year. And Zachary said, loved home ec. Basic use of the sewing machine is still handy.
Marty Harvey is a lecturer in the Department of Communication at the University of Texas at Arlington. She teaches journalism and is also a Community Voices columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Her column on home economics appeared on DallasNews.com. Marty, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, and Happy New Year to you. Before we get into home economics, I wanted to mention the fact that you teach journalism classes, but you run something called Math Lab for the first week of classes. Can you explain what that is?
Basically, since I teach reporting and also editing, there's a lot of fact-checking involved in the work that the students do. And I noticed that they were not able to check some of the facts and things that I had presented them. Mostly it had to do with property taxes, how to find a percentage increase, comparison shopping, you know, things like that. And so I decided to institute this kind of life skills thing in my class because I think to be a good reporter, you need to know about basic life. And so we started doing that. And I kind of laughed when I first did it because I would tell my colleagues, I would say, I could see their eyes roll back in their head and they start foaming at the mouth, you know, when I would say, it's going to be math class in a liberal arts class. And yeah, it was a lot of fun. But it turns out that they do learn a lot.
Did they react to it in a positive way?
Very positively. Very, yeah. Well, you know, at first they were, not math. And, you know, but yeah, after we figured out what we were doing, it was really fun.
When did it become apparent to you that this was something necessary and vital for your students?
I remember asking them to write a story from a city council meeting, and taxes were going to increase. And so they needed to give an example of how the average tax increase would affect a homeowner. And they were not able to figure that out. So I thought, well, if they can't figure that out, how can they first of all present it to other people? And then how can they know if the information they're getting from officials or whoever's giving them that information, how can they know if it's true?
Now, I took home economics class in high school. Did you? And if so, what do you remember most about it?
You know, I did. And what I remember the most is learning to cook a really killer meal.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, I'm in the South. I grew up in the South. And we do learn a lot from our parents. But my mom was a single parent and didn't really have time to teach us those kind of things. And so I will tell you, I graduated high school only, or junior high, only knowing how to do macaroni and cheese from a box. And when we had the home ec class, we were forced to actually create a menu, create a budget, go shop for the stuff, create the meal, give it to our family, and let them rate us on the meal. And it was really fun.
Marty Harvey is a lecturer in the Department of Communication at the University of Texas at Arlington. She wrote a column in the Dallas Morning News about home economics and bringing back home economics in schools. We had a number of Facebook comments in regards to this topic. Debbie on Facebook said cooking, household budget, checking accounts, credit cards, how health insurance works are some of the many life skills that students need. Besides that, what other skills for life do you think young people are lacking today?
I think a lot of what I see, because I'm a college teacher, is basic things like time management, how to fit everything you need to do in a day. And we learned that in my home ec class. We actually went through it. You know, what do you do in a week and where do you need to devote your time? So I see a lot of that. I see students who are, I guess I would say, not very sophisticated in finances. They just don't understand how their FICO score affects things, how interest rates can affect the car that they're going to buy. Or I always get that comment in class when we start talking about taxes, where a student will say, yeah, I had a job and I got my first paycheck and I realized they took taxes out. And so it's, you know, it's a real big kind of like shock for them to go, oh, they took $50 out of my check. I didn't know they were taking.
We had another Facebook commenter named Jake. He had some regrets about his decision not to take home ec. He said, as a teenager, I had zero interest in taking the course, and my parents couldn't make me, as we did all of our course selections for the next year online in our school. I really missed out on some of the fundamental basics that home ec taught and didn't learn until years after I graduated. I would definitely like to see this course as a mandatory credit. It sounds like several schools still offer it, but might have some competition with some other classes. What do you think about the appeal overall of home economics?
I think if students really knew what it was, it would be more appealing for them. And if parents realized how much it affected them once they got out of school, I think parents would be all for it. When I was in high school, which was many years ago, We had home ec, but the boys tended not to take home ec class. And in my class, one of the boys decided they wanted to take home ec so that they could be in the class with the girls. And
that was me. That was me,
that
by
was
the way.
You. Okay.
Yeah, that was exactly one of the reasons why I ended up doing it.
Well, what ended up happening is a lot of the boys decided to do it, so they created a boys' class. But I think it would be better to have boys and girls together talking about how things like this affect their lives. You know, it's really good. And once they realize they can learn to cook a good meal or, you know, something like that, they get really interested and get really kind of competitive with it.
Speaking of co-ed classes, we had a few Facebook commenters who also talked about shop class in addition to home economics. Pam said she wishes girls would have been allowed to take shop and home economics. Gail said, though, she grew up on a farm. She was a 4-H member, took home ec, and had a mother who canned and gardened. She wishes that she could have taken a shop class. She's grateful that she had a dad who taught her a lot. What do you think of a shop class as an addition to home economics?
Well, as a woman who has a really rough time handling tools, I would have loved it. I'm redoing my house right now. In fact, I came in and I have paint in my hair and was telling the person here about that. And going through doing things with my home, I am not good with a screwdriver or anything. And I really wish someone would have taught me how to do that, how to use a saw, how to use a level, you know, the basic things you need to make your house not fall in around your ears.
Darlene on Facebook said that she did take both home ec and shop classes. They were required for graduation, but she feels she learned more from her years of 4-H and growing up on the dairy farm than in the classes. Now, do you think that our everyday experiences and duties in childhood are changing and maybe even creating a bigger demand for an instructional class like this?
Well, I think that, the instructional demands are changing. What I'm seeing, though, is that they're changing more toward, at least in the area where I live, more toward testing. So students are kind of taught to the test, and they're not really given opportunities like 4-H or home ec or shop class as much because they need to meet these milestones that are set with the test. And I think those are the kind of classes that allow students to be creative, to learn problem-solving skills. I mean, what better class than 4-H to learn how to solve problems? You know, you've got so many things going on with farming that you need to figure out. So, yeah, I think we should really look back at that and kind of take a step back from the constant testing they have to go through.
We're talking with Marty Harvey, a lecturer at the University of Texas at Arlington and a Community Voices columnist for the Dallas Morning News. She says we need to bring back home economics classes in schools.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you take a home economics class in school? What did you learn? Are you still using it today? Do you think more schools should offer more home economics options? What's missing if we don't have it? If you teach or have taught that class, love to hear from you too. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or join the many people who have posted on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up this conversation in just a bit right here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Darrell Connor. We're continuing our conversation with Marty Harvey, the lecturer at the University of Texas at Arlington. We're talking about one of her columns for the Dallas Morning News about why schools should bring back home economic skills.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you took home economics classes at some point in your school career, do you still find them useful today? Do you regret not taking those classes? Do you think there should be more home ec options in our schools at whatever level? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And let's go to the phones. Let's go to Aaron in Green Bay. Good afternoon, Aaron. Welcome to Central Time.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you. I am just calling to say that I am a home ec teacher. I teach family consumer science, which is the new form of it in a high school in Green Bay. And my students love it. I love teaching it. part of the problem that we are currently having is that we can't find enough certified teachers. We can't find enough teachers to go to college for family consumer science education, and it's really hard to find a program. To my knowledge, there's only Stevens Point and Stout in our state that offer it. They're not graduating a whole lot of certified teachers in the program, and we are just having a really hard time filling the spots of some of these older retiring teachers.
Erin, thank you so much for the call. Marty, what do you think? How can we address the issue of what Erin describes as the dearth of teachers who could be really useful in this arena?
Well, I think one of the things we do, we tend to be a society of extremes. So we're at the point right now we're trying to send people into STEM kind of careers. And a lot of our energy and funding is spent doing that. I think not a lot of people can see the what would be really good that would come from a home ec class. And so it's really not funded the way these other things are. However, I think administrators and legislators also need to think about people coming out of high school or even college without the ability to manage their money, to know how to lead a productive life in some ways. And I think those classes would actually be much more, the money would be better well spent on classes like that. Now, we don't want to get away from STEM, but I think we need to kind of have a good balance.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Sandy in Mount Horeb. Good afternoon. Welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Oddly enough, I am a legislator, and I have been serving on the Education Committee in the legislature for 16 years. So I couldn't agree more, but here is the problem. What do you move in order to make room for this particular mandated class? And I think mandated is not a bad idea. And I would also suggest that maybe a different name for it, home ec, sort of conjures up the home ec class I was forced to take in high school. You know, home ec for girls, shop for boys. We baked, they built birdhouses. So something more like adulting or life structures or life management, things like that.
Oh, sorry about that, Sonia. We lost you a little bit. Marty, what do you think? Would a name change... Would that help in at least the perception if it's home economics that people will look at this and think it, oh, well, that's for girls. It's not for me. Maybe a change in how you word the classes may help.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Home ec, you know, we go back to the 50s, the 60s and picture, you know, women sewing and taking typing class, I guess. But really, I think what she said about calling it adulting would just be fabulous.
Yeah.
it would really relate to young people these days. But it also brings to heart exactly what it's about. It's about being an adult and learning to manage your life so that you can be productive. And what better way to do it than to, you know, call a class adulting and show them what they're actually going to be doing?
You know, we had one Facebook commenter that pointed out that these classes used to be steered toward particular genders. And what we were just talking about, Jim said, mm-hmm. when I went to school back in the Stone Age, there weren't any boys in home ec classes right. or girls in the shop classes. I thought it was a disservice to both. Each should have to take those classes. I mean, do you think the fact that home economic classes kind of came from this era where women were expected to be housewives and that's just affected the whole curriculum?
You know, it has. It really has, because those classes are very gender specific. And if we tried to take it away, like the you know, adulting would be, it doesn't really, you know, point to one gender in particular, and it would be much better to get people into a class like that. I don't know what we would do for shop class, but I would love to hear a name for that to keep it from being so gender specific for boys, because I know we were really dissuaded from doing shop classes or anything like that when I was in high school. Now, I'll tell you that was in the late 70s, which has been quite a while, but I do still see people kind of steering women and men into different roles. For example, I teach in a communication department, and we have a lot more women there than we do men. But then you could go over to the engineering department in the same school and see just the opposite. And I think it has to do with the way they're steered coming out of high school, either by parents or advisors or whomever.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Carol in East Troy. Good afternoon, Carol. Welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I'm a retired teacher from Family Consumer Science, and I definitely see a need for it today. I call it life skills. It's teaching them how to be critical thinkers and how to make a decision with compromising with other people, especially like in a kitchen situation where you have a crew of people and you have to learn to get along with people that sometimes are difficult to get along with, just like in life. And you have the success of being able to cooperate and to find out that you can have fun and still come up with a very good product that we enjoy eating. And I just think that so much is taken out of the school for people that don't really have an excel in a regular normal classroom, and yet with consumer science, you're using all the skills. You're using math, you're reading, you're learning to project ideas, you're learning to compromise, and I just think it's a wonderful place to incorporate science, too.
Thank you so much for the call, Carol. What do you think? Marty, she talked about the fact that we need to bring this back and we need to bring all other types of classes back. What is the process in doing that?
Well, that's a really long process. Here in the state of Texas, it is, I don't even really know if it could be done at this point with school funding the way it is.
Sure.
And also with just the way people see what education should be. So I don't know. I really wish they could see the benefit in this because, as your last caller said, you know, these classes take into account science, math, your liberal arts skills. It teaches you critical thinking. And I don't know of a better way to do that than, like she said also, teamwork with the students having to do something together. I have a friend here in Dallas who is a high-end pastry chef, and he actually took a home ec class many years ago. This was in the early 80s, and it was part of what kind of showed him where he wanted to go with his life. And I tell you, he makes a whole lot more money than I do now.
You know, there's a lot of people who will listen to this, whether they listen to this program or whether it's come up in different conversations. They'll make the argument that these are the types of skills they should learn from their parents. In fact, we had a caller, unfortunately we can't get to him, that was holding, that said that there's nothing you also, you can't learn on YouTube or on the internet. What do you think about that idea?
Well, I've learned a lot of things on YouTube. You can learn how to cook a specific meal on YouTube. You can get some specific information. But I think this kind of class really gives you an overall look at life skills and enough basic understanding so that you can go forward with that understanding and learn the skills as you go. Now, I do hear the argument a lot that they should learn this in their home. A lot of parents work. A lot of parents don't have these skills. And a lot of parents also don't really want to bring their kids in on their personal business. So they don't do that. But another thing I've also found is that a lot of affluent families do so much for their kids that their kids are not given an opportunity to learn to do things. A lot of people see it as a lower socioeconomic issue, but with helicopter parents, you know, sometimes it's an issue getting students to know how to do things for themselves.
Marty, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for spending the time.
Thank you.
Marty Harvey is a lecturer in the Department of Communication at the University of Texas at Arlington. She teaches journalism and is also a Community Voices columnist for the Dallas Morning News.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, after more than a century in the works, lynching is now a federal crime. We'll look at the impact of the new legislation and more tomorrow on Central Time. weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. It's the morning show. Tomorrow at 7, there's a new governor on the way with the old legislature still in place. Join the conversation about the key issues for 2019 in Wisconsin politics. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show.
Coming up next is the news from NPR and WPR. And then we'll discuss the latest news out of Washington, including the government shutdown, Mitt Romney's critical op-ed about President Trump, and more. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.